From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. What might President Trump say tonight to make his case to the American people for his border wall? A stalemate over the wall between Democrats and the president has pushed a government shutdown now into its 18th day. Vice President Mike Pence previewed Trump's primetime address this morning on NBC.
He'll explain the need not just to build a wall, which he's determined to do, but also to provide our Border Patrol with additional resources, humanitarian and medical assistance, new technology. But the Democrats need to come to the table and start negotiating. But tonight, the president will take that case to the American people.
And afterwards, the Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi will deliver a joint response. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith will be watching. Hi, Tam.
Hi.
And in that Pence interview, he evaded some questions about whether the president would declare a national emergency to build a wall without congressional approval. He did say the president's considering it. Let's listen. Independent Senator Angus King spoke to NPR's Morning Edition today about that.
Everyone's speculating on what the president's going to say tonight. He may well declare a national emergency, which then authorizes the use of military construction funds to take them away from other authorized projects and apply them, in this case, to the wall. I think that's really a stretch. The courts will ultimately decide that, but that may be where he's headed.
Well, Tam, what would it mean if the president were to declare a national emergency? Tell us some more of the questions around that.
Well, so first to say that Pence is insisting that it's not their first choice. We don't know whether it will happen tonight. We don't know if it'll ever happen, whether this is being something that's dangled out there as a threat to try to get Democrats to compromise or whether this is a real plan that could be executed. We do know that the White House counsel's office is looking into it, and the president says he is very seriously considering it. But some of the considerations are whether it is truly legal. A couple of people I spoke to say that they think it is, that the president's ability to declare a national emergency is pretty unlimited. The question is whether there is a statute for sort of the next step after that, like what do you do once you've declared the emergency? Whether and what I'm told is that it would be sort of a stretch to try to use the military to build the wall under the statutes that exist. But if the president and his lawyers determine that they can do it, they will certainly try. It will no doubt be legally challenged. Lawsuits. Congress could also try to step in and do a repeal of some kind to push back on the emergency declaration. But we would be in really uncharted territory at that point.
I talk about the fact that this is the president's first national address from the Oval Office. That's usually reserved for very big deals. It sends a very big message. And there'd been intense pressure on the networks not to air the speech because of concern from the president's detractors that he's using the platform to drum up his supporters, but with falsehoods. And there have been falsehoods, you know, the claim of 4,000 terrorists coming across the southern border. State Department says the number is actually more like none. But do the TV networks really have a choice if the president asks?
Well, the TV networks do have a choice. They've made their choice.
Yeah.
They are going to both air the president and they are going to air Democrats. The White House is treating this very much like a State of the Union, even though it's only going to be 8 minutes long and it's not going to be delivered before a joint session of Congress. They are doing the full court press. The vice president, as you mentioned, has been out doing interviews. The vice president will be up on the Hill trying to make the case to Republicans before the speech. And what they're really trying to do here is sell the idea that there is a crisis along the southern border. Mm-hmm. They have not yet succeeded at selling it. One sort of remarkable thing to think about is that we are 18 days into a government shutdown, and just now the president is giving a speech to the American people to explain why he thinks that there needs to be a shutdown.
No. Look, meantime, we just have about a minute, but the president's feeling pressure on the foreign diplomatic front. You have Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in the Middle East trying to reassure allies that a pullout from Syria won't mean letting down the U.S. Guard on Iran, for instance. But National Security Advisor John Bolton traveled to Turkey to try to get a pledge the Turks won't attach the Kurds. The Turkish president wouldn't even meet with him. It feels like a bit messy.
You know, it does feel a bit messy. And welcome to 2019. It's a lot like 2018, which was a lot like 2017.
Yeah.
You know, there have been so many moments very much like this moment, obviously not an 18-day government shutdown, but there have been many moments where the president has made an announcement that has, caused a dust-up with allies around the world, where his foreign policy team sort of eases him back from that. And there have been domestic fights, too. We're in the midst of the Trump administration.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Key, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, stocks jumped again this morning after the Trump administration said there's been progress in trade talks with China. A whiff of good news, perhaps, for the cheese industry, which is currently dealing with a 1.4 billion pound surplus of cheese. Enough cheddar, American and Swiss, sitting in cold storage across the U.S. to form a wheel of cheese the size of the U.S. Capitol building. And it's in part because Mexico and China aren't buying it up. Let's bring in Andrew Novakovic, professor of agricultural economics at Cornell. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you.
And this is the biggest cheese surplus the U.S. has seen since the government started tracking this a century ago, 16% larger than the 2016 surplus when the government offered to buy up $20 million worth of excess cheese. How did we get here?
Well, as always, it's a combination of things. Part of it is just the amount of milk being produced on farms. Part of it is changes in the domestic use of that milk. Of course, cheese is the single largest category of usage, but part of it is trade, or more specifically export markets, which is mostly a self-inflicted wound, but also one that's had some gray clouds on the horizon for a couple of years.
You're talking about the trade war, and cheese shipments are down 10% to Mexico and 63% to China as of September.
And particularly important is Mexico is far and away our biggest customer. And of course, one of the few foreign customers we can serve with a truck instead of with a boat. And so that disruption has been particularly difficult for the cheese industry. And Mexicans are great consumers of cheese.
What about Americans? Are they changing their habits? And is that helping to lead to this surplus?
Well, there's a up and down on the cheese story for what we're doing in the U.S. The single largest type of cheese produced and consumed in the U.S. is mozzarella or pizza cheese. And that continues to roll right along. Sales are strong. People are still eating the kind of food that sort of cheese goes on top of. What has changed and changed fairly noticeably and fairly recently is people are turning away from processed cheese, the kind of cheese that usually gets melted on a cheeseburger or other sandwich in a quick serve or fast casual type restaurant, and they're upgrading to other types of cheese. But there's a lot of volume of that so-called processed cheese that's been lost as people are switching around. And it's also the case that we're seeing increased sales of kind of more exotic, specialty, European-style cheeses. Mm-hmm. Some of those are made in the U.S., so a lot of them aren't. And typically when you're substituting an expensive cheese for an inexpensive cheese, you won't buy as much. And so there's a lot of moving parts in that whole cheese thing. But sort of on net, sales are below trend.
How are cheesemakers adapting to those changes in what Americans are interested in eating?
Well, they're still learning how to adapt. The move towards the more exotic specialty type cheeses has been happening now for a few years. And so there's been more people expanding into that area. But as you might imagine, it's a little trickier making those cheeses. And a very large commercial firm that's set up to put out large volumes of a commodity type cheese doesn't easily get into saying, well, how about we make some Camembert? And so that transition has been ongoing, but it's a little on the slow side.
And as somebody who's studied the American dairy industry for some time, what's the long-term solution here?
Well, it's the same as it is for everything else. If you've got too much of something, the price has to go down until consumption rises because it's a good deal and production goes down because it's not. And we've been looking at price adjustments, low-level price adjustments, for 3 or 4 years, and a lot of farmers would say, well, make it stop. But the fact of the matter is we're still pushing out a little bit more milk than we know what to do with. And really, it's not a big number. But until those two numbers get reconciled, we're going to continue to see these low prices. If we could get ourselves back in a better trade situation, that would help quite a bit. I mean, we would like to have as much of the help be on the demand side as we can.
What's your favorite cheese?
My favorite cheese?
Mm-hmm.
Colby.
Okay, good. If I want a fancy cheese, I'll go with a Humboldt Fog. I think that's a really good one. But if I'm just having, you know, a sandwich, I'm a Pepper Jack guy.
Oh, Pepper Jack. Actually, you want to try, maybe you've tried it, you want to try a really nice Italian-style cheese. There's a company in Wisconsin owned by a guy by the name of Jim Sartori. It goes under the Sartori label. He's got several versions, but it's called Belvitano. It's a variation of Parmigiano Reggiano. Mm. I think that's probably the best cheese made in the United States. I mean, there's a lot of really great cheeses, but that one is amazing.
And now we're all hungry. Andrew Novakovich, professor of agricultural economics at Cornell University, thank you.
You're welcome.
I know you're thinking, a cheese wheel the size of the Capitol?
Yeah.
You gotta be kidding me. Well, stocks jumped again this morning after the Trump administration said there's been progress in trade talks with China. A whiff of good news, perhaps, for the cheese industry, which is currently dealing with a 1.4 billion pound surplus of cheese. Enough cheddar, American and Swiss, sitting in cold storage across the U.S. to form a wheel of cheese the size of the U.S. Capitol building. And it's in part because Mexico and China aren't buying it up. Let's bring in Andrew Novakovich, professor of agricultural economics at Cornell. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you.
And this is the biggest cheese surplus the U.S. has seen since the government started tracking this a century ago, 16% larger than the 2016 surplus when the government offered to buy up $20 million worth of excess cheese. How did we get here?
Well, as always, it's a combination of things. Part of it is just the amount of milk being produced on farms. Part of it is changes in the domestic use of that milk. Of course, cheese is the single largest category of usage, but part of it is trade, or more specifically, export markets, which is mostly a self-inflicted wound, but also one that's had some gray clouds on the horizon for a couple of years.
You're talking about the trade war, and cheese shipments are down 10% to Mexico and 63% to China as of September.
And particularly important is Mexico is far and away our biggest customer. And of course, one of the few foreign customers we can serve with a truck instead of with a boat. And so that disruption has been particularly difficult for the cheese industry. And Mexicans are great consumers of cheese.
What about Americans? Are they changing their habits? And is that helping to lead to this surplus?
Well, there's a up and down on the cheese story for what we're doing in the U.S. The single largest type of cheese produced and consumed in the U.S. is mozzarella or pizza cheese. And that continues to roll right along. Sales are strong. People are still eating the kind of food that sort of cheese goes on top of. What has changed and changed fairly noticeably and fairly recently is people are turning away from processed cheese, the kind of cheese that usually gets melted on a cheeseburger or other sandwich in a quick serve or fast casual type restaurant, and they're upgrading to other types of cheese. But there's a lot of volume of that so-called processed cheese that's been lost as people are switching around. And it's also the case that we're seeing increased sales of kind of more exotic, specialty, European-style cheeses. Mm-hmm. Some of those are made in the U.S., so a lot of them aren't. And typically, when you're substituting an expensive cheese for an inexpensive cheese, you won't buy as much. And so there's a lot of moving parts in that whole cheese thing. But sort of on net, sales are below trend.
How are cheesemakers adapting to those changes in what Americans are interested in eating?
Well, they're still learning how to adapt. The move towards the more exotic specialty type cheeses has been happening now for a few years. And so there's been more people expanding into that area. But as you might imagine, it's a little trickier making those cheeses. And a very large commercial firm that's set up to put out large volumes of a commodity type cheese doesn't easily get into saying, well, how about we make some Camembert? And so that transition has been ongoing, but it's a little on the slow side.
And as somebody who's studied the American dairy industry for some time, what's the long-term solution here?
Well, it's the same as it is for everything else. If you've got too much of something, the price has to go down until consumption rises because it's a good deal and production goes down because it's not. And we've been looking at price adjustments, low-level price adjustments, for 3 or 4 years. And a lot of farmers would say, well, make it stop. But the fact of the matter is we're still pushing out a little bit more milk than we know what to do with. And really, it's not a big number. But until those two numbers get reconciled, we're going to continue to see these low prices. If we could get ourselves back in a better trade situation, that would help quite a bit. I mean, we would like to have as much of the help be on the demand side as we can.
What's your favorite cheese?
My favorite cheese?
Mm-hmm.
Colby.
Okay, good. If I want a fancy cheese, I'll go with a Humboldt Fog. I think that's a really good one. But if I'm just having, you know, a sandwich, I'm a Pepper Jack guy.
Oh, Pepper Jack. Actually, you want to try, maybe you've tried it, you want to try a really nice Italian-style cheese. There's a company in Wisconsin owned by a guy by the name of Jim Sartori. It goes under the Sartori label. He's got several versions, but it's called Belvitano. It's a variation of Parmigiano Reggiano. Mm. I think that's probably the best cheese made in the United States. I mean, there's a lot of really great cheeses, but that one is amazing.
And now we're all hungry. Andrew Novakovich, professor of agricultural economics at Cornell University, thank you.
You're welcome.
I know you're thinking, a cheese wheel the size of the Capitol?
Yeah.
You gotta be kidding me.
And we want to take a look now at technology teachers are using to keep parents informed about how their kids are doing. Open grade books aren't really books, but online and up-to-the-minute progress reports. Efficient, but are they healthy?
KQED's Tanya Mosley has been looking into this, and she joins us now from San Jose. Hi, Tanya.
Hi.
So tell us more, first of all, what are open grade books and how common are they in schools around the country?
Well, if there are parents or students in middle or high school listening to this, they know exactly what we're talking mm-hmm. about. In simple terms, open gradebooks are these online sites that allow teachers to post assignments, announcements, and message students and parents and post up-to-the-minute grades. And almost all public schools in the country use some sort of system. We're talking about dozens of companies that offer this service, so they are pretty common.
Yeah, I was helping a teen recently, Tanya, who struggled in school. He not only got grades through a system, but the breakdown of the grades, you know, the percentage of class participation or homework.
That's right.
Yep. When they were good, they were inspiring. When they weren't, they were so in your face, they were devastating. I know you were getting daily updates on your phone for your 11-year-old daughter, Audrey, and you asked her about it. Let's listen to a little of that.
Do you feel like me, that I play a part in the pressure you feel?
Yeah, just a little bit, because it seems that if my grade does decrease, then I know that my grade has decreased, and I'm coming home worried on what my parents are going to say.
Oh, so Tanya, how is this going over in your house?
I have to say, my heart breaks a little every time I hear that clip, because I can hear the quiver in her voice. So my daughter's in sixth grade, and she started to receive or be a part of the open gradebook system earlier this school year. And I would receive every night in my email box an up-to-the-minute detailed report on how she was doing in her classes. And at first, I thought this was really great, because I have an understanding and I know what's happening in her classroom. I can talk with her during dinner besides how was your day or how was school today. Mm-hmm. But over time, she started to seem very stressed out about the conversation. And she told me that she and her classmates often talk about their grades with each other. She looks at them before she comes home. And I also made a big mistake. There was a time, a moment when she was struggling in a class and her teacher was talking with her about it through the portal, through email. Mm-hmm. And I responded to the teacher. And I realized later that I was not giving her the allowance to actually make mistakes herself and figure out solutions herself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you also wonder how, as a child, you're supposed to race home before the mail arrives so you can grab the report card and hide it from your parents. That's not possible with this. Is there any data at this point from researchers, Tanya, on whether this technology is actually helpful?
Well, there's one study out there from Seton Hall University in New Jersey that found there was a slight uptick in grade performance for students of a lower socioeconomic status. There was no change for students who come from wealthier families. But to your question, there's not been a lot of research on the mental health impacts of access to your grades every day. I reached out to several mental health doctors who told me anecdotally they've counseled students who feel a lot of anxiety and pressure to excel. A lot like my daughter, they feel stressed out that their parents have access to these grades. Mm-hmm. Steve Adelsheim, he's a clinical professor of psychiatry at Stanford University and the director of the Center for Youth Mental Health and Well-Being. Here's what he had to say about all of this.
You know, we talk about innovation in this area a lot, but you know, the notion of innovation also includes being able to feel comfortable trying things and risking and failing. And when our focus is always on being successful and getting the A, we're not allowing necessarily the room for creativity, the room to attempt things.
Yeah, but you know, Tanya, it feels like this horse is out of the barn. You know, ed tech, multi-billion dollar industry, not just open grade books. Some schools use apps to let parents know about behavior issues immediately or to keep parents updated. There are apps with pictures from the classroom. So
right.
what do you see of how technology is changing schools?
Well, ultimately, and you're right, EdTech is an $8 billion industry. So it's a huge industry. The promise from these companies is that they'll give districts, many of whom don't have a lot of money, the ability to harness all of this data to improve student outcomes. And really, we're so early in this process. We're talking about 15 years we've been using, give or take, these types of systems. And so everyone's calibrating. They're trying to figure out what's the best way to use them. And so many of the doctors that I talked with suggested that first off, we have some sort of education on how much parents should be looking at the grades, how they should talk with their students about the grades, and perhaps school districts should take a proactive approach to talk with parents themselves about ways that they can interface with their students instead of checking grades every day and perhaps making students feel pressure along with that interaction.
And bottom line, Tanya, in just the few seconds we have left, your advice to parents who are having to deal with this?
Don't look at the grades every day. You actually set the parameters. You can set beyond the default and maybe get grades once a week or once a month. And use this as a way to talk about what your child is learning and not necessarily the grade itself.
It's Tanya Mosley of KQED in San Jose. Tanya, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Colorado now, where Jared Polis was sworn in today as the state's 43rd governor, a five-term Democratic congressman who is openly gay and who began his career as a successful self-made businessman almost immediately. Colorado Public Radio's Ben Marcus explains how this former entrepreneur won Colorado's top elected position.
Our story starts in the early 1990s. Jared Polis is living in the dorms at Princeton University. Now, before many people even knew what the internet was, he says he and some buddies decided to get together and start an internet access company.
With like 10 modems and a server, and people could dial in, you know, the old and they would be able to access the internet.
For the kids out there, that's the sound of a dial-up modem. Polis eventually sold the company for more than $20 million. He graduated with a political science degree. And then he helped take his family's sleepy greeting card company and put it online. E-greeting cards became all the rage, and Polis says BlueMountain.com took off.
It actually grew to become the sixth most popular site on the internet during the holiday months in 1999.
His family sold the company at the height of the dot-com bubble for $800 million. That gave Polis the freedom and the money to pursue politics. He didn't waste any time. When Polis was just 25, he jumped into the usually low-profile race for State Board of Education. His Republican opponent, Ben Alexander, says he couldn't believe the rumors at the time that Polis had vowed to spend more than $1 million on the race.
Yeah, I jokingly said I ought to write him a letter and just give me a check for $500,000 and we'll save you $500,000 and I'll step out.
All that money helped Polis win, and actually he's won every race in his political career. The loser, Ben Alexander, though, realized something, that Polis and his allies don't just want a school board seat. They want to remake politics in Colorado.
And in many respects, they have been successful.
And a few years later, in 2004, Polis helped shock the political establishment.
From NBC News, Decision 2004, election night.
It was a great night for Republicans. George W. Bush won re-election. Republicans swept state houses across the country. But in Colorado, Democrats had managed to take control of both the Colorado State House and Senate for the first time in a generation. This was at a time, too, when Republicans had a commanding voter registration advantage here. Rob Whitwer, a former Republican lawmaker, wrote a book about it called The Blueprint.
To say that Colorado Republicans were stunned the morning after Election Day is a gross understatement.
Polis was a member of the so-called Gang of Four, a group of wealthy liberal activists that employed money and tactics never seen before in Colorado.
Well, there's no question that Jared Polis, with his tech background and as a funder of this coordinated effort, really saw the synergies between financial resources and the application of data.
Now it's common for campaigns to spend big to collect reams of data on voters to target turnout efforts. And through the years, Polis has continued to use his vast personal wealth to support a wide range of issues and candidates. We analyzed two decades of campaign finance records, and Polis has donated to more than 400 different political groups in Colorado, supporting things like ethics reform and politicians, both big and small. In 2008, Polis, the candidate, jumped from the State Board of Education to Congress, spending millions of his own money on the race.
In these times, we need leaders who understand how to create jobs. Jared Polis does.
Polis has held the second congressional seat, stretching from Fort Collins to Vail to Boulder, for the last 10 years. He's the first openly gay man elected governor in the nation. He's married with two kids. And in Congress, he was a champion of gay family rights. He was also an early supporter of Obamacare.
One of the great benefits of the Obama health care plan is that we will allow people to pursue their potential, to create jobs.
But there's no one issue that defined Polis in Congress. He defies easy categorization. On most things, he's a liberal Democrat. But he has this libertarian bent. He once advocated privatizing the Postal Service. And Tom Cronin, a professor emeritus of political science at Colorado College, says Polis established himself as a tech and education expert.
He has a reputation, having been a collaborator on a lot of legislation, very active on education committees, and his staff liked him a lot. I know former students who have worked for him, they liked him a lot.
Now, as governor, being likable will only get Polis so far. He faces daunting challenges from education to transportation to healthcare. He spent $24 million of his own money to win this chief executive seat, and he'll have more control than he's ever had to shape the state of Colorado. For Here and Now, I'm Ben Marcus in Denver.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The union that represents actors and stage managers on Broadway issued an order yesterday barring its members from participating in workshops for shows in development. As Jeff London explains, the dispute is about getting actors more share of the profit.
For decades, the traditional route to Broadway for plays and musicals was the out-of-town tryout. There are legendary stories about how shows like Oklahoma and Fiddler on the Roof fixed their problems in Boston or Washington before triumphing on Broadway. But now about 25% of shows that make it to Broadway work out their kinks in 4-week-long developmental labs in rehearsal rooms in New York City. Including really big shows like Hamilton.
I am not throwing away my shot. I
am not throwing away my shot. Mary McCall, executive director of Actors Equity, says it allows the creative team to get a show on its feet.
Take a look at it, see what it looked like, maybe put an audience in front of it of investors or others, so the playwrights and the producers and the directors and choreographers could see how the piece was being received and make changes.
12 years ago, the union worked out a contract with the Broadway League, the organization that represents producers and theater owners, for developmental labs. That contract, which paid Equity members $1,000 a week, expired in 2017. And Charlotte St. Martin, the league's president, says,
"We've been talking about it for a couple of years, and things ramped up late last year. We're still in negotiations, and until late last week didn't realize that this action was going to be taken."
This action is the Do Not Work Order. The union's Mary McCall explains.
This Do Not Work Order tells our members that they may not do development work, so they can't work on a lab contract, they can't work on a workshop contract. There are many different components of development. They can't do any of that work.
The sticking point is not just a raise in salary, but the union's insistence that members of developmental labs receive a percentage of royalties if the show moves on to a full production. McCall says it isn't a lot of money.
This ask of 1% of any net profit to be shared by every actor and stage manager that participates in any of the development of the show. So that could be 1% being shared by 10 people. It could be 1% being shared by 40 people. And it is of net profit. So the producer makes back all of their original expense to mount the show. All of their capitalization expenses are back, and they are now making profit.
In other words, $10,000 out of every $1 million for every show which turns a profit. And only one out of every 5 Broadway shows does. Although such musicals as Frozen and Mean Girls have already agreed to Equity's terms, the league's Charlotte St. Martin says,
"It's a different way of doing business than our producers have been accustomed to doing. So that's what we're talking about."
Right now, 4 developmental labs are affected. New musicals based on the films Almost Famous and August Rush, and 2 jukebox shows based on the songs of Huey Lewis and Michael Jackson. Charlotte St. Martin hopes they'll be back on track soon.
"We have every belief that we'll be back at the table in the next couple of weeks. We have new proposals to make. Negotiations are negotiations."
In the meantime, Actors Equity has set up a social media push with the hashtag NotALabRat. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Cyntoia Brown, the former teen sex trafficking victim serving a life sentence for murdering a man who'd paid for her, will soon be free. Yesterday, Tennessee's Republican Governor Bill Haslam granted clemency to Brown, who's now 30, and became a hashtag cause after the documentary Me Facing Life, the Cyntoia Brown story. We covered it in 2017. In it, her lawyers say she suffered fetal alcohol syndrome because of her birth mother's drinking, ran away from an adoptive home, and was taken in by a predatory pimp named Cutthroat. She testified in court that when she was 16, a man named Johnny Allen hired her and showed her his gun collection.
"If he does something to me, I'm sitting here thinking, what can I do? I'm in his house. Ain't nobody gonna know where I'm at. My mom and them, they don't know where I'm at. The people that I stay with, Chick on them, they don't know where I'm at. Nobody's gonna know what happens to me. Cut, he doesn't care. He doesn't even know who I left with. And all this is just running through my mind, and I'm just a nervous wreck."
She said she pulled out her own pistol and shot him for self-protection. She was tried as an adult in 2006, convicted of murder, and now clemency. She'll be out in August. Charles Bone is one of Cyntoia Brown's attorneys. He's in Nashville. Charles, you told her yesterday. What was her reaction?
Well, Cyntoia did a little dance. I did a little dance. We all were very, very excited to share that news with her, and she's so thankful and looking forward to the future.
Well, she's going to finish her bachelor's degree in May 2019. She also got her GED, has a newfound faith, which she expresses quite a bit. But you know that there are people in Tennessee who are going to be angry about this. There are prosecutors arguing that she killed a man and so should serve the time. There's also the law. In 2010, the Supreme Court ruled against life without parole for juveniles. The state argued that this didn't affect Santoya because the state law has an opportunity for review of a case after 51 years. So they made the case that, look, after 51 years, somebody does have the chance at parole. You are obviously arguing against that. The case, all of this goes away now. But what impact do you think this will have on the so many young people who are in jail, maybe arrested on prostitution charges? And maybe many advocates say they, like Santoya, are actually the victims of sex trafficking.
Well, we would think that this would give hope to those who are still in prison, who are under similar circumstances, and hope that if they rehabilitate themselves in any way like Santoya has, that some governor somewhere would recognize that rehabilitation and give them the same opportunity that Governor Haslam has given Santoya.
What did you think when she became a cause? It was so many years after the documentary, after she went to jail, when suddenly you're hearing from Rihanna and Kim Kardashian tweeting out Free Santoya Brown.
Well, the team who's been working on this and Santoya are very grateful for all of the support she has had. We were shocked that it became such an international opportunity for people to speak out on this issue. And we don't think that necessarily that the governor at all considered all of the international outreach and the telephone calls that they received. But he did really study and pay attention to the rehabilitation of Santoya.
Yeah. And Charles, what is she going to do now? She's 30. Will we hear from her? What's she going to do?
Well, you won't hear from her, I don't think, until August when she's released, and maybe not even then. This transition is for her is so important. You know, you just have to think about the fact that a 16-year-old who's never had a driver's license, you know, never voted, I never had a job, would now at age 30 begin that walk outside the prison walls. And and I think she'll be a great voice for those who need hope that they can also survive and become the viable citizen that she's going to be.
Well, as you say, first she's got to figure out how to live her own life. And she'll have 10 years of parole, correct?
That's correct.
Charles Bone, one of the lead attorneys for Santoya Brown, the teenage sex trafficking victim serving life sentence for murder, but just granted clemency by Tennessee's governor. She will be out in August. Charles Bone, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in Texas, a plaque that's been displayed in the state capitol building since 1959 could be removed soon because it features what's called the Children of the Confederacy Creed. The creed says that the Civil War was not a rebellion and that the preservation of slavery was not an underlying cause. Texas's Republican Governor Greg Abbott and members of the State Preservation Board will meet this Friday to discuss the plaque's fate. Joining us now is Ben Philpott, senior editor at KUT in Austin. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
And first of all, explain for us what the Children of the Confederacy is and how its creed ended up being displayed in the halls of the Texas State House.
You know, the Children of the Confederacy is just one of the dozen groups or so that sprung up in the South, especially around the time around the 1950s, to try and create a little bit of a revisionist history of the Confederate War and the reasons it was fought and trying to place those, you know, what they would consider heroes of the Confederacy back in public view. And of course, there's also some that say, well, the reason they wanted them back in public view was to make sure people of color knew their place in the South.
And this is not the first time that this plaque has raised controversy. Several Texas lawmakers have called for it to be removed over the decades. But a Democratic state legislator named Eric Johnson renewed those calls in August of 2017, just after that Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. What is Johnson and what are other state lawmakers who are on his side saying is wrong with this plaque?
Well, it's just factually inaccurate. I mean, the whole idea of that slavery was not the underlying reason for seceding from the Union. You know, if you just look at Texas's own declaration of the causes for why the state needed to secede from the Union, slavery is mentioned multiple times, including here's one quote. It says that slavery is an institution that, according to the document, the Declaration of Causes, is, quote, which her people intend should exist in all future time. So this was something, of course, that they brought up in their declaration of why they wanted to secede from the Union. And the plaque's just, you know, just lying, basically.
And so what has changed now to make it so that there actually could be a successful movement to get rid of the plaque?
Well, I think they're not going, you know, Representative Johnson and others are not at this moment going after, you know, the dozen or so other Confederate plaques or monuments that are around the Capitol. They're not saying take down the giant statues that commemorate different, you know, brigades of Confederate soldiers that fought and died in the war. They are saying take down this plaque because it is simply not telling the truth, and that there's a difference from the idea that some say of preserving history and simply removing things that are not true. And so I think that's where this has maybe gained a little more momentum.
But what about those other Confederate markers? Don't you think that people are going to start coming for them next?
Well, I think that you could have an argument on some of the things. Like, there's a portrait of Confederate President Jefferson Davis up in the Texas Capitol. I believe it's in the state Senate. You know, there you could probably make an argument there. Well, why are we honoring someone who was the president of a rebellion against the United States? But I don't know. I don't know how much further this is mostly being led by Democrats and people of color. And I don't know how much further they will get in a state that is still, you know, 100% controlled by Republicans. And of course, the majority of them being white.
But interesting that the governor, a Republican, has said that he's OK with it coming down.
Yeah. And again, I think it goes back to this idea of this is quite clearly factually inaccurate. Mm-hmm. And the idea of honoring a war dead, even Confederate war dead, is not necessarily factually inaccurate. You know, they did die, they did serve the Confederacy, but it's the argument there is, of course, you want to honor them for being in a rebellion, or, you know, can you just leave it up to say, yes, these were Texans who died in a war?
That is Ben Philpott, senior editor at KUT in Austin, Texas. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
If you're a parent trying to communicate with your infant, you may have given baby sign language a try. There's a huge market for books, classes, and smartphone apps that teach parents and babies signs for words like hungry, thirsty, and more. Often these programs claim that baby sign language can speed up spoken language development and even boost a baby's IQ. But there's not much research to support that. So is teaching your baby to sign worthwhile? Let's bring in Gwen Dewar, an evolutionary anthropologist and author of the website Parenting Science. Gwen, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And does this work? Through the research that you've seen and you've done, do you think that baby sign language is effective?
Well, it depends on what you mean by effective. I think that it's possible to teach babies to sign, and it can be a valuable activity for parents to engage in with their babies. They can tune into them and have fun, just like any kind of activity that's a learning activity that you can do with your child. The question is this going to make your baby a better language expert? And on that score, actually, there's really no evidence that it's going to help.
So it might not help in the long run, but it might help in the short run. Can babies understand the concepts needed to say, I want more milk or something like that, and how to communicate that even if they can't say it at the time?
Well, yes, they can, but I should point out that babies are already engaging in spontaneous gestures, and so you don't necessarily need to teach your baby an abstract sign in order to communicate about things like that. That's the thing I want to get across, is I think if we're talking about baby sign language and we think it's a program where they import a bunch of official signs where there's an arbitrary connection between the sign and the meaning, that's could be a fun thing to do, but that's not as if that's going to be a something that's going to allow the babies to learn especially fast. Whereas if you focus on those transparent signs and the ones that your baby already uses, that could be really valuable.
They can just make a signal with their hands that might not be the official ASL signal, but it just says, this is what I want.
That's right.
So the Mayo Clinic says that there is limited research to suggest that baby sign language might give a typically developing child a way to communicate several months earlier than those who only use vocal communication. Do you agree with that?
I would have to say that is very limited, and it's better to just say we don't know. The kind of research that we have on that are small studies of infants who are being taught to sign by parents who are deaf and use sign language as their regular language. And then they would look at the babies and at what point did they start babbling with their hands and when did they start saying their first words. And if you look at research like that, those studies really fall within the bounds of what we see with verbal studies of when babies first start babbling verbally and speaking their first words.
So do you think that parents are wasting their money when they invest in apps and classes to teach them and their babies sign language?
Well, I think it depends on your goals. To me, what's really interesting about the research is other research that's not about teaching babies sign language, but about observing real parents who use gestures in a really effective way. They look at what babies are pointing at. They use pantomime. Parents who do that have what is called referential transparency, meaning that you are easy to decipher. And if you think about it, if you were a person who went off to some country where you didn't happen to speak the language and they didn't speak your language, you would really want to talk to people who are very good at miming and reading natural gestures. And there's been studies done showing that parents who have that quality actually have babies that do acquire language faster and do seem to have advantages. So I think gesturing is very good and very effective. It's just the question is, do you need to do kind of a formal program that teaches babies abstract signs, which are harder to learn?
So whether or not baby sign language is an effective way to teach your child how to communicate, the way that most people teach their baby to communicate is to teach them how to speak. Do we have it all wrong? As you look at what works and what doesn't work, do you think that there would be just a better way to communicate with your baby and give them lifelong skills in communication?
Well, I think actually we know a lot about the best ways to communicate with babies. You need to make eye contact with your baby when you're talking. Studies show that when you do that, the part of the brain that tunes in with communication is more likely to turn on. You engage in conversations with your baby. Even though your baby can't speak, you communicate as if your baby is able to do that, and you interpret her looks and her gestures. And when parents do that, when they tune into the mind of the baby and really try to imagine themselves from the baby's perspective, research shows that when you do that, babies learn things really fast.
What makes parents good at that?
Well, I think that there's something called mind-minded parenting, and that's simply realizing from the very beginning when your baby is born that this is an autonomous being who has a mind and is, you know, intelligent and not just an object that needs care. And so when parents start out with just assuming that their babies have independent minds, that's really the key. It's really pretty simple.
That is Gwen Dewar, who's an evolutionary anthropologist and author of the website Parenting Science. Very interesting, Gwen. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And parents, we'd love to hear about your experience with this. If you've tried teaching sign language to your baby, does it work? Let us know at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.